physical union in mutual desire will give harmony and poise to their nervous system. Love will blend desires and aims into one and bind the personalities together. The acquisition of a common fund of knowledge will make companionship closer. Belief in similar concepts and principles direct their lives into the same channel. Spiritual aims and ideals of the same order complete their union, until, consciousness having risen to the level of pure spirit, this great love engendered between two souls will overflow all limitations and draw the whole universe into the bounds of their union. When this is achieved, it is held by the esoteric philosophers that the greatest stimulus which it is possible to give from the physical plane is applied to evolution. These two, thus mated upon all planes, go enter into the light and go not forth again as separate individuals, but become one individual with a two-sided nature, complete in itself and self-fulfilling. Such beings, however, have passed to a higher order of life than ours and are uncognizable by our senses. Chapter 16. The laws of mating upon each plane. Mating upon each plane depends upon actual continuity of the substance of that plane. Thus, upon the physical plane, union depends upon the interlocking of the generative organs and the injection of the male secretion into the female receptacle. Upon the second plane, mating is held to have taken place when desire is mutually inflamed, and a man looketh upon a woman to lust after her, and she experiences a similar passion towards him. Upon the third plane, union depends upon emotional sympathy, and on the fourth plane on a common content of consciousness and interest. On the fifth plane, intellectual sympathy determines the mating, and on the sixth plane mutual spiritual ideals. On the seventh plane all are one and one is all, no closer union being possible than that which has existed from the dawn of manifestation. A peculiarity of this composite mating will be found in the fact that upon certain planes like mates with like, and upon others opposites are attracted to each other. In the first case the units augment each other, and in the other they supplement each other. Upon the first plane opposites are drawn together, each being attracted by the difference in the body of the other. Upon the second plane attraction depends upon a mutual rousing of a similar passion, and their like attracts like. Upon the third plane difference again makes the attraction, those who have great powers of love being drawn towards those who need affection. There the protective instinct demands a mate that shall lean and make demands upon tenderness, while those who seek the comfort of love need the compassion and protection of their mate. Upon the plane of the concrete mind a similar content of consciousness makes for sympathy, thus those who are interested in the same subjects find much in common, whereas upon the plane of the abstract mind those who approach their intellectual problems by different roads make the best mates, the critical counter-checking the imaginative, and the deductive illuminating the inductive. Upon the sixth plane mating depends upon ray color, those of similar spiritual type mating with souls akin to themselves, and union being impossible between those of divergent rays. Now it is said in esoteric science that mating upon each plane depends upon actual function, and individuals are said to be mated only so long as they are functioning in polarity. When the rapport ceases, mating ceases. Mating, therefore, must not be confused with marriage, which is a legal contract and depends for its validity upon the laws of equity and not upon actual function. Marriage is a contract entered into between the man and woman on the one part and the child on the other, and will be dealt with in a separate chapter. This concept of marriage is only mentioned here in order to make clear the difference between marriage and mating as understood by the esotericist. Mating upon the physical plane endures only for the few moments of coitus. It can take place with any member of the opposite sex within the limits of the species. Upon the second plane mating continues as long as desire continues, that is to say, only during the breeding season or those years in the human being during which desire is active. Third plane bodies are mated as long as there is affection. Should the fourth plane body, with its content of consciousness built up during an incarnation, become mated, that mating will continue for the whole of the incarnation, and nothing but death can annul it. When, however, mating extends up to the fifth plane between people of like ideals and principles, it has come into the sphere of the individuality which endures for an evolution, And for the remainder of that evolution will the bond continue, the souls waiting for each other and finding each other in life after life, and making that wonderful tie which, when once formed, will bring them together from the ends of the earth and break all earlier chains. When union is confirmed on the spiritual plane, then the pair become one in actual fact and substance, and they are entering the light, return not again. It will thus be seen that the esotericist's concept of mating is very different to the popular one. He declares mating to be a matter of actual function, and to cease when the function ceases. On the other hand, should mating extend to the physical plane, then there is always the possibility of offspring from the union to be considered, and to bring into the world a child for whom there is no home is to do that child a cruel wrong. The Church, guided in many cases by men who had a profound illumination, knew that when a true spiritual union took place the bond was unbreakable and of a sacramental nature, and held up this ideal as the standard of Christian marriage. The teachings of the Church are truly applicable to a mating of individualities and rightly describe its conditions, but what shall be said concerning a union in which only the lower levels of the personality are concerned? This is in no wise a sacramental union, but simply a satisfaction of a physical need and instinctive desire, and should be considered from the standpoint of hygiene rather than theology. The Church, guided nowadays by men who are further removed than the early fathers from the source of inspiration, makes no distinction between the two types of union, but applies the highest ideals indiscriminately, giving a sacramental blessing to that which is of no loftier a type than the conjugation of animals, and demanding of mortal clay that which only the spirit can afford. Were the Church more sparing of her blessing and less exacting in her standards, especially towards those not of her fold, we should be spared much social confusion. No one knows better than the esotericist the indissoluble nature of a sacramental union, but he maintains that such a union can only take place between individualities which endure for an evolution. In this respect he goes even farther than the Churchman, holding that such a union is not even broken by death. The attitude of the Churchman is illogical in this matter, for if two beings are sacramentally united, then, if those beings are immortal, their union must endure throughout their immortality, and the death of the body of one party would not affect the bond. The truth of the matter, as conceived by the esotericist, is that the union of individualities is sacramental and indissoluble, but that the union of personalities, or any level of them, continues only so long as function continues. The fact, however, that such union produces the vehicles needed for reincarnating souls complicates the whole issue, which otherwise was simple enough. The rights of the children cut across the rights of the parents, and, from the point of view of the race, are paramount. Chapter 17. The Esoteric Teaching Concerning Air Twin Souls. It is well known to all observers of human nature that certain people seem to bring out the best in each other, or that, when they are together, each nature seems to blossom and to become capable of greater heights of development than could be reached alone, and at the same time a wonderful joy and radiance pervades them. Should they be parted from each other they droop and wither, and though time serves to alleviate the bitterness of severance, neither soul rises to its full stature in solitude. There may be no mournful and self-pitying brooding over the past, no morbid refusal to transfer interest to fresh objects, but there is an abiding sense of life lived below its normal level. Such people may even fancy that they are not two separate entities, but the halves of a single whole. The close sympathy and perfect rapport between two such minds causes every mood to find its reflection in the other, so that the grief of one will plunge both in sorrow, and joy rejoice them equally. Popular thought is well aware of these conditions, and the hope of their attainment is hidden in every heart. However much experience may teach the unlikelihood of its realization, yet the hope ever springs up anew, so deep-rooted among the instincts is it. But though the hope is universal, its realization is rare, for a complete union with another demands complete abnegation of self, and souls capable of such selflessness are few. For such a union two equally selfless souls must join, it is not enough that one should give completely and the other merely receive. It is not even enough that each should give his or her all, Each must give what the other needs, otherwise the sacrifice is unavailing, and herein lies the key to many of the problems of unrequited love. A good comradeship is the best that most men and women can expect after the heat of passion has cooled with familiarity and the lessening of physical beauty, and though such a comradeship is one of the noblest and most beautiful things on earth, yet it is not that closer mating to which we refer, and popular thought is well aware of this and has designated such mates as a twin soul, so knowing that the bond far surpasses that which is known as married love, beautiful and profound as it is. The close and lifelong bond of married love, for whose fire the passion of lovers is but the kindling, is built of a thousand mutual needs, tendernesses, memories and sympathies arising out of companionship. This early love knows no building, but is born full grown and transcends all other ties, or, should the ties be maintained, breaks the soul. Such a strong bond, that springs into being mature, cannot be regarded as a new birth, it is rather the reincarnation of a passion that was developed in past lives. Though the conscious mind is ignorant, the subconscious remembers and claims its mate. The phenomenon of this love in physical being is exceedingly rare, though commonplace passion or sudden emotional sympathy are easily exaggerated by their hungry souls into something higher than their reality. Individuals of a lowly evolution, and these are most liable to sudden and uncontrollable passions, are too egocentric, too bound up within their own limitations and appetites, to be capable of a lasting and harmonious union with any creature. Still less can they realize the ideal of complete selflessness and service which is implied in the concept of another who shall be as one's very self. They have but little to bestow in return for the satisfaction of their hungry desires, and the one who undertakes to minister to these soon grows weary of the unrequited task. The great majority of people are capable of a perfectly harmonious and satisfactory union with any member of a given type, or, in the language of esoteric science, with anyone who is upon the same ray as themselves. As was remarked in a previous chapter, spiritual mating can only take place between those who are of the same ray color, but whenever we meet one of our own ray, there is a sense of fundamental harmony because the line of evolution and the spiritual qualities are the same, whether these qualities be highly developed or rudimentary. It is only upon fundamental harmony that a lasting and satisfying union can be built. It is useless to expect that development shall strengthen a tie when that very development is taking place in different directions. If a man should devote his life to a military career and attain eminence therein, it would be unlikely to draw him nearer to his wife if she had devoted hers to the cause of peace between nations. Any person who is sufficiently evolved to be able to conceive an ideal and strive towards it must have regard to the ray color, denoted by the type of idealism, in choosing a mate, though the low types, who have no idea beyond self-interest, can mate on a basis of mutual passion and physical attraction and find as much satisfaction as they are capable of deriving from a union. It may be stated that although esoteric science recognizes the existence of a twin soul, so it does not hold that every case of sudden and violent passion between individuals is such an indissoluble union. It may be just what its name implies, passion and nothing more, dying down as quickly as it has sprung up and capable of renewal at the stimulus of a fresh object. Neither would esoteric science teach that the meeting of a twin soul, even if the supposed tie actually existed between them, was justification for any failure to discharge existing obligations, though our divorce laws may have little relation to either the facts of human life or cosmic law. To break them incurs the penalties of society, and to inflict hardship upon an innocent person is no part of the path of enlightenment. Rather, the esotericist would hold that as a single life is but a stage upon the soul's journey through evolution, we do best to sacrifice one short day of our existence in the honorable fulfillment of a bargain, so that future lives may be free from past debts and the great love harmoniously attained. Chapter 18. The nature of the ties between souls. A. The karmic tie. Esoteric science recognizes two types of tie that can draw souls together and bind them in a common fate. These binding ties, which originate upon the inner planes where the unseen causes operate, must be carefully distinguished from mutual attractions that arise upon the plane of effects, cognized by the physical senses. The commonest type of bond is known as the karmic tie. The term karmic, adjective of karma, is borrowed from the Eastern esoteric school, and is used, for convenience sake, to denote the forces, both good and bad, set going in previous incarnations. No corresponding English term exists, the word fate, its nearest equivalent, having come to mean, especially in its adjectival form, a force exclusively evil. The karmic tie between souls has its root in attractions experienced in past lives. Attraction may occur upon any of the six planes of individualized existence and be of a nature appropriate to that plane. The attractions exercised upon the first or physical plane are simply a matter of physics. Gravitation, capillary attraction, absorption, and similar processes take place upon the subplanes of dense matter, and magnetic attraction, chemical affinities, etc., manifest upon the etheric subplanes of our world. Emotional attraction does not exist below the second plane, where it makes itself felt in the urge of the instincts. Therefore, no tie is formed by mere physical propinquity, and emotional action and reaction have to occur before any bond is established. It is reaction which is the essence of the bond. The fact that one person feels an emotion towards another does not link them together. It is only when the object of the emotion reacts towards it that a bond is formed, because he has then, as it were, taken into his own nature the force proceeding from the other and so formed a continuity of substance, however ethereal, and it is by means of this imperceptible thread that much of the work of practical occultism, both black and white, is performed. Should one person love another and the love be reciprocated, a bond is formed. Should one person love another and the love be returned by hate, contempt, loathing, or any form of resentment or unkindness, a bond will also be formed, and for the rest of their incarnation these rapports will influence the lives of those whom they unite in degrees proportionate to the intensity of the emotions that are experienced. It is only complete indifference that prevents a tie from being contracted. Any emotional reaction sets up a rapport. An action and its answering reaction upon any plane set up a rapport, whether the instincts be roused upon the second plane or the emotions on the third. The relationship of teacher and pupil or fellow student upon the planes of the mind, or of priest, spiritual guide, or fellow worshipper on the sixth plane. Upon whatever plane an action and reaction take place, a bond is formed between the two interacting units. These bonds may set up the most intimate relationship, or be a momentary contact immediately forgotten by those concerned, but as long as any emotion in relation to the memory exists, the rapport will remain. Should emotion towards a particular person still be felt at the time of death, this emotion, having no means of gratification in the subjective state that follows on death, is stored up until, objective existence having been resumed in a new incarnation, the conditions for its expression are again available. It is this unexhausted emotion which forms the karmic tie, and though it waits for hundreds of years, as time is reckoned in revolutions of the earth, it loses none of its force, but reacts to the same objects that previously stimulated it whenever those objects shall again become present. Hence the sudden outrush of a love at first sight and the sense of understanding and intimacy which a twin soul so experience. Each renewal of a karmic tie increases its strength, and though it may start as the merest carnal attraction in the childhood of the race, as body after body comes into function in the course of evolution, the rapport will spread from one to another until a great spiritual mating be achieved. If, however, the bodies of the pair fail to develop synchronously, then a strong bond will exist upon the lower planes, and the higher self of the more advanced individual be left unmated and unsatisfied, possibly loathing the response of its own lower nature to a degrading attraction, yet unable to free itself therefrom. Such a predicament threatens danger and suffering and frequently causes those tragedies of passion and crime that in all periods of history bear witness to the primitive forces that civilization seeks to control. A karmic tie, however, only develops great strength when all the forces of the nature are concentrated upon a single object with great intensity of feeling. This happens comparatively rarely, unless the desires are thwarted under tragic conditions. A consummated passion usually sleeps the sleep on repletion, but should those who love be parted, either by circumstances or by death, then the unfulfilled love remains as a bond upon the third plane, which for a long time is unaffected by the death of the body. If the parting be by death, and if the survivor, either in sleep, as often happens, or by means of psychic development, become conscious, even momentarily, of the third plane of existence, the bond that exists thereon will draw the two souls into contact again. This is the true means of communication with the departed, to exalt consciousness so that we become aware of their state of existence, not to recall them to awareness of our mundane condition by means of a medium. A medium should only be resorted to in the case of a soul that is earthbound and cannot proceed to its own sphere, and then only for the purpose of giving it quittance. The third plane is the sphere of existence referred to in spiritualistic literature as the heaven world, but before the outgoing soul, released from its body, can attain to this state, it has to pass through a phase of second plane existence known as purgatory, where arrears of evil are paid off in the suffering brought about by subjective realization, thereby adjusting balance of fate. Once the soul is released from the deadening influences of the physical body, all subtle forces become increasingly tangible, and although the newcomer cannot transcend his own plane of existence till his debts be worked out, the soul that has gone on ahead may, if sufficiently evolved, make telepathic contact with him for short periods, and so give help and comfort upon the hardest part of death's journey. As soon as the soul of the newcomer has risen above its purgatorial experience, it enters the AE heaven world and is then upon approximately the same plane as its mate. No barrier of differing states of existence now keeps them apart. The bond of love exerting its natural attraction draws them together. They can then pass the rest of their time between incarnations in companionship. The bond between them will tend to draw them into incarnation again at the same time and under similar conditions, and then upon meeting will come that strange uprush of subconscious memory so incomprehensible to those whose philosophy does not extend beyond a single life on a single plane, but so readily explicable in terms of the esoteric doctrines. Should two souls be drawn together life after life by these means, in each life loving and companioning each other and steadfastly eschewing all other attractions, the bond thus formed will become very strong. This, however, but rarely happens. It does not require many incarnations, with the long discarnate periods that intervene between them, to take us back to the ages when human civilization was in its infancy and nothing loftier than second plane unions were being formed. As is well known, low-level unions are formed with great facility and are of little endurance, so that a soul, even in the course of a single incarnation, may have formed several ties of this nature, especially in civilizations where polygamy was practiced. Each of such unions will be able to exercise a drawing power in proportion to its intensity upon the plane on which it took place, so that the soul that has contracted such unions, and few have not, will be pulled in different directions by the ties it has formed. Let us consider the progress of a soul through evolution, sometimes in a male body, sometimes in a female. In the earliest phases of human evolution, union took place simply in response to the promptings of instinct, as it does now among animals. Thus only two bodies were involved, the physical body, by means of which the union was carried out, and the desire body of the second plane, which prompted the union. A first plane union can take place with any member of the opposite sex of the same species that has attained a sufficient age, and such a union, involving no emotions, leaves no trace. Second plane unions depend upon the arousing of mutual passion, and such an experience modifies the soul to this extent that it will readily experience a recrudescence of its passion when it again meets an individual that has once shared in its excitement. This accounts for those amazing intoxications of the senses which sometimes lure men and women into experiences that leave bitter regrets behind. But although these second plane attractions can cause a wild ebullition of passion which it requires considerable force of character to master, they are usually short-lived. It is not until a soul has evolved sufficiently to be capable of a third plane union that a bond is formed which extends beyond the senses and is capable of influencing character. Even here, several unions can be formed in a single incarnation. Esoteric science does not teach that souls are created as twins, but that such unions are built in the course of many incarnations, and it will be seen from the preceding paragraphs that many vicissitudes may befall the soul while it is still at a primitive and unevolved stage of development, and these fleeting unions entered into at the bidding of the instincts. The only mentors that primitive types recognize, militate one against another and prevent any lasting union being formed, for it is only by the fidelity of many lives that the union known as a twin souls can be achieved. Should, however, two souls be so strongly drawn together that each has the power to hold the other against all comers, then, provided they are not too dissimilar in type, as body by body comes into function in the course of evolution, they will mate upon the higher planes, and that wonderful union of perfect sympathy and understanding, so beautiful and so rarely seen, will be achieved. Should, however, the pair be of different spiritual type, then tragedy will occur as the higher natures come into function and draw them apart at the bidding of a different idealism. Ancient faiths, such as the Catholic and the Jewish, with their roots deep in the esoteric lore of the past, know this, and therefore forbid intermarriage with those of another communion. It will be seen from the foregoing pages wherein lies the danger of light and promiscuous relations popularly referred to as the sowing of wild oats. Such unions set up a rapport that is easier formed than broken, and lay snares for the soul in future lives. Among primitive peoples, who have much knowledge of practical occultism, a great deal of attention is given to sex magic, one of the most potent forms of magic that exists, and in many parts of the world there is considerable traditional knowledge of genuine occult methods in addition to an acquaintance with aphrodisiac drugs, and the men of a higher civilization, who abuse their power in reference to women of primitive tribes, sometimes find that they have involved themselves in a bond that is not easily broken, and contacted forces whose subtlety is only equaled by their unpleasantness. B. The cosmic tie. There is an aspect of the sex relationship even less understood than that which has been outlined in the foregoing chapter. The bond between souls which is known to esotericists as the cosmic tie is one of the most profound and potent, and at the same time most beautiful, of the secrets of the Western esoteric tradition. European civilization has always valued women highly, holding that if any half of the citizens of a country is in a retrograde state, the standard of evolution for the whole race must be lowered. The general attitude of the white races is reflected in their esoteric tradition, wherein it is held that souls, while incarnated in the negative or feminine vehicle, have not only got special lessons to learn, but also special potencies, and the greatest importance is attached to the cooperation of male and female forces in any work involving practical occultism. In certain orders it is the custom to keep the lodgy membership evenly balanced between the sexes, and not to allow the predominance of either sex to go beyond a certain proportion. Taking electricity as a type of force closely analogous to the invisible potencies which underlie the visible world and determine its conditions, the occultist knows that every force must have, not only an outflowing from the divine, but also a path of returning, also that any form which acts as a transmitter of such force must have a positive and negative aspect. The male vehicle is positive and the female negative, and therefore the practical occultist finds that for certain types of work it is necessary to function in partnership or polarity, for only thus can a circuit be set up and a flow of cosmic force be induced. As has been explained in a previous chapter, the vehicles corresponding to the different planes are positive and negative in relation to each other. The individuality is positive in relation to the personality, which is negative towards the higher potency of its greater self. If an individual is sufficiently evolved to have any of the levels of his individuality in function and fully correlated with his consciousness, He can cause the flow and return of cosmic force to take place within his own organism, and thereby attain a considerable degree of power and enlightenment. For instance, the spiritual ideals and aims, and the abstract perceptions of principles belonging to the fifth and sixth vehicles can be used to illumine and inspire the activities of the personality. On the other hand, for the use of the greater potencies and the operations of the higher occultism, it is necessary to have a pair working in polarity. Only so can the great cosmic voltages be carried without the danger of a-thing are so well known to all practical occultists. The pair, working thus, open a channel for the divine forces which flow through them with astounding power, and magnetize not only themselves but their immediate neighborhood.